Augustine commented somewhere in his writings that there's one form of nostalgia that ought to be counted a mortal sin. Mortal sin to him was a sin that was worthy of death, in contrast with lighter sins that might not be worthy of that kind of punishment or that one might recover from. But he thought there could be few things worse than just reveling in the past and allowing it to darken the present and blot out the hope of the future. There is a kind of wandering in the good old days which allows the good old days to become the enemies of the days that are left. And I'm sure that's what he was aiming for. You find it in a passage like Psalm 137, where the Israelites have been carried away into Babylon, and the psalm begins, "By the rivers of Babylon we sat down and wept." And they began to note that their captors were wanting a song from them. If that were the only reaction the exiles had in Babylon, it would have been not enough perhaps to face the future with. There were other reactions. But they could remember the time when Solomon's temple was beautiful in Jerusalem, when the conquering army came through and flattened that temple, when most of their strong young men were killed in battle, and when many of the ones who were left were taken away into captivity in a strange land. And because of that, they could only think of the past. They wished they were back in Jerusalem. As we come to the end of a year and begin to evaluate, as Phil did with us this morning, where we are and where we're going and where we've been, we at least have the possibility of using memory. We human beings have a choice. We can use it not only for bad purposes, that is, as a place where everything good was and nothing good is now or is expected to be, it's all over. Those were the good days. Or we can use it for teaching and instruction and for hope for the future. Arnold Toynbee says that there have been 21 great civilizations in the history of mankind. And he asserts that 19 of those 21 have fallen through internal decay rather than through the force of an external invader. At least it was the internal decay that made the nation easy pickings for the next group that came along to start the next great civilization. So if one is able to look through the past and keep that kind of decay from occurring, refresh himself for the future, that's a helpful use of memory. And the other is to find hope, because this is not the first time in Babylon that the descendants of Abraham have ever been exiled. They had been exiled before down in Egypt, where they had gone to buy grain in Jacob's day and found themselves enslaved. But God had laid bare his arm of strength and delivered them with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And that seemed impossible to do. What God has done, God can do. So as we look back to the past, we can either revel in it and say there'll never be another year like this one. Next year doesn't hold much for me. Everything is gone that's good. Or we can look at it from the standpoint of finding something there that teaches us how to live and that gives us hope for the future because God is still acting. Now the book of Deuteronomy, from which the text came tonight, is, I think, an especially good place to talk about the proper use of memory. No fewer than 80 times the New Testament quotes the book of Deuteronomy. That's a good percentage of all the quotations of the Old Testament to be found anywhere in the New Testament. It must have been a favorite book of Jesus and of his apostles. It's cast in the form of three speeches. Moses stands on the verge of the Jordan. Some of you may have had the opportunity to visit the spot. It's hard to forget. Over on Nebo, just east of the Jordan River, and you turn and look westward across the Jordan and you see the land of Canaan. In that day, it was a land that flowed with milk and honey. Today, it doesn't have quite that attractiveness about it. But as Moses stands there, knowing that he's going to die, talking to a generation, only two of which really know what Moses knows about the past, Caleb and Joshua. Because the older generation has died out in the wilderness. Moses delivers three speeches to tell Israel what God has done, how he has led them, and then the book closes with a kind of charge to them about the future. All the way through Deuteronomy, all the way through those three speeches captioned the second law, Moses is saying, remember, remember, remember. Take heed lest you forget. There are three themes that come up for special notice. One of them is, remember Egypt. At least 50 times in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses looks back to the land of Egypt and their slavery there. If you have a Bible, I'm going to start reading some sections. Deuteronomy 4, verse 20. But the Lord has taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be a people of his own possession, as it is at this day. God brought you out of the iron furnace, or verse 34 of that chapter, Deuteronomy 4. Has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs, by wonders, and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? Has there ever been a time when any of the nation's gods performed in such a way as God did, when by might and by terror and by war he brought you out of Egypt? What's the purpose of all this? Chapter 5, verse 6. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. It's because God has delivered them. If they remember that, they are to obey him. Or verse 15. You shall remember you were a servant in the land of Egypt. The Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Because God led them out of Egypt, they keep his Sabbath. Or chapter 10, verse 19. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Three or four times in the book, Moses uses that appeal. God brought you out of Egypt. You love the slave. Love the person who's disenfranchised, because one time you were in that same position. Now, let's look back at chapter 4 and verse 9 for a second theme. Many times in the book, Moses points back to Horeb, another word for Mount Sinai, where God had given the law. Chapter 4, verse 9 is one of those instances. Take heed and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen. Remember, you were just children. We came down to Sinai, but you saw it there. Verse 10, how in the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, the Lord said to me, gather the people to me that I may let them hear my words. And then verse 11, you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain while the mountain burned with fire to the heart of heaven, wrapped in darkness, cloud and gloom. The Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, saw no form. There was only a voice. And he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform. That is, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them upon two tablets of stone. Remember Horeb. Remember the time you stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and God gave his covenant on two tablets of stone. Remember Egypt, where you were enslaved. That'll prepare you for the land you're about to go into. And then chapter 8, verse 15, just after the text for the evening, he points to one other motif, the wilderness. 40 years they've been in the wilderness. We ought to call it desert because it's just a barren, sandy desert. There are no trees there, if that's what wilderness suggests to you. There weren't then, apparently. Verse 15 of chapter 8, he says, that God led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. Brought you water out of the flinty rock. Back in chapter 1 in verse 31, he says, in the wilderness where you've seen how the Lord your God bore you as a man bears his son. God had carried Israel like a child. When there was no water, he brought it forth out of a flinty rock. Or look at chapter 9 in verse 7. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. Part of this you won't want to remember because you weren't always what you should have been in the wilderness. From the day you came out of the land of Egypt to you came to this place, you've been rebellious against the Lord. And then back to chapter 8 and verse 2. God led you these 40 years in the wilderness that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He let you hunger. He fed you with manna to make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Now, three motifs he's gone to. You were slaves in Egypt. You came to Mount Sinai and heard the voice of God there. You've wandered in the wilderness, have done without, and God is providing for your needs. What's the purpose? To teach you to love him. Chapter 6 and verse 5, he says it. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Or again in chapter 8, beginning with verse 17, the other purpose. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it's he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant with you, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. If you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you this day that you shall surely perish. Now, I think enough of the reading for us to see what we've come for. Moses reminds this younger generation of what God has done for them, because it ought to lead them to obey God, to love him with all the heart, soul, mind, and strength, and be a warning to them, because the time is going to come when you're over in that land and you'll have houses you didn't build, and they'll be filled with goods that you didn't raise. You'll reap crops you didn't plant. You'll drink water out of wells you didn't dig. You'll have so many things God has provided, but be careful. When you get wealthy, when everything is just right with you, you may forget where you got it. And you may say, my power, strength of my hand, got me this wealth. And you turn away from the true God. There have been a lot of applications in the book of Deuteronomy. I think it's very likely that in 2 Kings 22 and 23, when young Josiah, at about the age of 16, had given command for the temple to be cleaned out and the book of the law was found, that it was the book of Deuteronomy that was found. It was brought before the king. He rent his outer clothes to show that he was repentant. If that's God's law, we've departed from it. And he set loose a restoration movement of sorts in Israel. That was Deuteronomy's power, to bring them back to remember what God had said from Mount Sinai and what they ought to be doing, which they had neglected to do. It's a very simple view of history that we have here, and it may be that we'd question that view of history. Do you mean it's so simple that if I will do what God said, I love him with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and remember that he's the one who gave me everything I have, things will go well with me? And if I forget that, I'll perish? Looks like nations rise and fall for lots of other reasons than that. But be careful about throwing away the book of Deuteronomy easily. When this book was written, the people around Israel had a circular view of history. History was like a Ferris wheel. You get on here, you get off there, but the river just keeps rolling. The Ferris wheel just keeps turning. There's no meaning about it. It's purposeless. But in the midst of that kind of view of history, God gave the Hebrews a view. It wasn't one they originated. It wasn't one they thought out for themselves. On the anvil of history, God took that circle of meaninglessness and hammered it out into a rod. And he showed Israel that he had a purpose in history. He was unfolding it. He was going toward a goal. Nowadays, we have almost a view of inevitable progress. We have so much technology, things are going to get better and better. The world has to become a finer place in which to live. Even that is probably borrowed from Deuteronomy, though it's a corruption of it. Because in Deuteronomy, it depends on whether you remember the Lord. If you rebel, then you perish. If you remember that he's the one who is leading history, he's the one who's giving you what you have, then you go toward an end, a goal. I think there's quite a message here, both for the nation and for the church. America, I don't think we should speak of as God's chosen people in the sense Israel was, but we've certainly had our share and more than our share of blessings. I don't think we should look back at our history and think of it as sacred history, as Israel's history was. But it's been a wonderful history. If you look at America, the first thing you see is a rather shallow sense of history. This nation's only a little over 200 years old. We don't have very deep roots. We're a melting pot. A good percentage of our population hasn't been here anything like that long. Besides that, we move about so often that few of us have any roots that we can trace very deeply anywhere. And the result of all that is that we become extreme individualists, and we may miss what the nation as a whole has in the way of roots and what has made it what it is today. It's always been characterized by rugged individualism, sure, but it's still built on roots that are older than the land itself, inherited values from another land. I suppose historians will always come up with more and more reasons to explain the rise of the United States of America. If you read history, you'll find that sometimes it's an economic motif. They came here to get wealth. Sometimes it's a political motif. They came here for freedom. Sometimes it's a religious motif. They came here because they wanted freedom of religion. Whatever you say and whatever the motifs were, the religious motif is woven very deeply into the fabric of American history. The basic principles of our Constitution, the basic principles on which our land was built, are drawn again and again out of the highest religious ideals those early leaders had. It's true that men like Jefferson and Franklin can't be called Christians. Jefferson had his own version of the New Testament. He'd cut out the miraculous. He didn't view Jesus as the divine Son of God. He was a deist. He didn't believe this is a special revelation of God to man. He believed rather in a general revelation. But even so, his values have been shaped by Scripture far more than he probably realized himself. And those shapers of our country were themselves aware that their highest ideals were the religious ideals. Their highest commandments and laws had ultimately been grounded in religious laws. Now, I don't think there's anybody who isn't an heir of that heritage. It was G.K. Chesterton who once commented that Christians even preserve the ideals of pagans. He thought that those of us who are living by God's standard are the ones who are responsible for keeping society intact for the people who don't live by God's standard. I think there's real truth in that. But America has to be reminded. Each of us does as a citizen, and our nation as a whole needs to be reminded that we're built on a very deep foundation, just as Israel was. Not God's chosen people, but built on religious ideals. We can't just praise great godly religious leaders or God-fearing leaders. It was God who was behind this. I don't understand why God has blessed America as he has. It's hard to evaluate how richly we are blessed. Some say that our standard of living is twice that of other Western nations. That's hard to measure, but I don't doubt that. That it is 20 times the rest of the world. I don't doubt that. We've been given so very much. But that's the very danger Moses is pointing to. Beware lest you forget the Lord your God and say, my power and my might gave me all of this wealth. It's when we become fat that we're in greatest danger, he says, of perishing. I don't think we should see there a vengeful God. The moment we forget God, he's going to zap us. Rather, that's the nature of the universe. When we stop living by his laws, he created the universe. It's his laws that keep the universe in motion. We bring death to ourselves. We reverse the pattern of Matthew 6, 32 and 33. And instead of seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, we seek after all those things the Gentiles seek after when we forget God. When you forget God, you're going to sink back to that meaningless circle of life. We've just come through a presidential election, time of reevaluation for a nation. Looking for a national purpose is part of any such campaign. But can we carve a national purpose out of whole cloth? You have to have some reason for a national purpose. We can't just say we want to be this kind of nation and there's no reason for it. What we're looking for is an ideal, such as Scripture holds before us. Rudyard Kipling, in his Recessional, looks to the pagan and says, for heathen heart that puts her trust in seeking tube and iron shard, all valiant dust that builds on dust, and guarding calls not thee to guard. But then his prayer to God is, judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget. Lest we forget. His appeal is that the nation that doesn't forget is the nation that's going to live. That ought to be our concern, not just for our own nation, but for all those blossoming nations in the world. Asians, Africans, Latin Americans, who've been under colonial rule for so long and are now trying their wings. We Americans know what freedom is like. We know why people want freedom. But it wasn't Marxism that set those nations free. A long time before Marx was ever heard of, people under the banner of the cross were there trying to eliminate superstition, ignorance, disease, death, and hell itself for those people. The highest ideals come right back to the same source. It isn't just the nation. The church needs to have the same kind of memory, because we've been brought into a covenant written not on tablets of stone, but written on the heart. We've been redeemed not by flesh and blood, by silver or gold, but by the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot. So Peter said in 1 Peter 1. A friend of mine was called to hospital one night. He's a minister. to stand alongside an older woman whose life had suddenly been drastically altered. Earlier in the day, her only son had been involved in a terrible accident, and he now hovered between life and death. The news of that was too great for her husband, and so he lay in the next room of this small hospital with a terrible coronary. And here is the woman, standing waiting as both of them linger between life and death. And as the minister stood by her, she finally said with some calmness, "I'm not going to make any decisions about any of this until I see what God does with it." That's an awfully great expression of hope. To believe in those circumstances that God is still in his heaven, that somehow he can still do something good with it, is an important thing. One reason we're called to look back in memory is to realize that God before has led people like ourselves, and he can lead us if we don't forget and begin to think that we provided it all for ourselves. I read somewhere in an old history book the story of the report of Waterloo coming back to London. The English people knew somehow that this was one of those hinge battles of history when Wellington met Napoleon at Waterloo. But there were no electronic communications in those days, and on the huge squares of London they had billboards with movable letters, and they would put up a sign announcing news events with a headline. It was late afternoon, a fog was settling in, the letters began to appear, "Wellington defeated." And by that time the fog had dropped and people began to disperse, and the rumor spread throughout London that it was all over, all hope was gone. Next morning the sun was up, the fog was gone, and the rest of the sign could be read, "Wellington defeated Napoleon at Waterloo." It's a reminder that I've heard it applied to Friday afternoon when the crucifixion had occurred, but the fog was still over the land. Sunday morning had not lifted the fog yet with the resurrection. It's a reminder that we shouldn't give up till God is through. After all, God has a purpose, and we're looking for that purpose for us in history. Lest we forget, an appeal to come back and remember again God's purpose. I want to read you a rather long statement from John Henry Newman, 19th century Englishman. Because what he's saying in this statement is that you have a time, you have a turn. Once it was the apostles' turn, it was St. Paul's turn once. He did his part well. He was as a strong and bold wrestler in his day. At the close of it, he was able to say, "I fought a good fight, I finished my course, I've kept the faith." And after him, the excellent of the earth, the white-robed army of martyrs, each in his turn, each in his day, have likewise played the man. And so down to this very time, first one and then another have been called out to exhibit before the great king. It's as though all of us were allowed to stand round his throne at once, and he called on first this man, then that, to take up the chant by himself, each in his turn having to repeat the melody which his brethren have gone through. Or as if while the ring of bystanders behold and applaud, we in succession, one by one, were actors in the pageant. Such is our state. Angels are looking on. Christ has gone before. Christ has given us an example that we may follow in his steps. Now, it's our turn. And all ministering spirits keep silent and look on. Oh, let not your foot slip. Let not your eye be false, or your ear dull, or your attention flagging. It's our turn. We face 1985 with a memory of what God has done through this church, through us as a people. But it's our turn in facing a new year to see what God can do through us if we remember he gave us everything we have, and he simply calls on us to be willing instruments in his service. Do you need to begin that service? Could we help you while we sing to invite you?